B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who once described Caddyshack as an awesome documentary, Charlie Nance.
Welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. This week, the PGA Tour heads to beautiful, majestic Pebble Beach for the AT&T Pro-Am. And normally, I'd spend a lot of time talking about this, one of the tour's crown jewel tournaments. But this is the week that the USGA and R&A came out with their distance report. Now, there are two different conversations about this, one with Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, who I spoke to just hours after the report came out on Tuesday, and Ron Cyrak of RonCyrak.com and the Golf Channel, whom I spoke to on Thursday. After I had the chance to get good and mad at the findings, correction, not the findings, but the cowardice of the USGA and R&A on a lot of levels. But before we get to that, let's get things started on a happier note, with happier news. Bill Rosinski of PGA Tour Radio and Sirius XM was on the ground last weekend at the Waste Management Phoenix Open, and Webb Simpson's savage comeback for the win from two down with three to play. Bill, before we get started talking about Phoenix, I wanted to ask you this question as we just came off of Super Bowl Sunday, and you had the experience of calling a Super Bowl as a local broadcaster.
Mm-hmm.
How was your day different on that day being the local broadcaster for one of the teams as opposed to the way it is on any other given Sunday?
Well, you know, it really wasn't that much different. You know, we had been, prepping for the game for a couple of weeks. And, you know, we were, I got on one of the, this is kind of an interesting story. They had, the team buses were leaving from the hotel. And I usually caught any road game we did, I would catch the last bus. And usually on the last bus, you'd have, a few players, there'd be some coaches, staff, and in this case, they had two buses. So we get up there, and I start to get on this one bus, and one of the guys in the front office goes, Bill, come over on this one. I go, oh, okay. Well, my producer, Dave Lankin, got on the bus I was going to get on. I went on the other one. Well, as it turns out, this bus was like really the last official team bus that was going to go through security and pull into the stadium. The other bus was letting people outside. They had to go through security outside. And so we got in, no issue, and our poor producer is stuck in a crowd of like, I don't know how many thousands of people trying to go through security. I mean, it was, he was lucky he made the broadcast. We may have started without him, for all I know. I mean, I was never on the beginning of the broadcast, but that's how crazy it was. And the only thing different that day is sometimes I'd go down on the field before the game and, just kind of sit on the bench, watch guys warm up. I went down that day in Houston just to take in the atmosphere. And I kind of walked around the stadium, and some of the Panther fans would see me and know me and yell at me, and go, hey, let's go Panthers and all that. And the other thing I remember about that day is they were having a little pep rally for the fan base. This is probably like 2 hours before the game. And they asked me to come over and, talk about the Panthers. So I was up there. I was talking smack to the Patriots fans, and I think that was the year Aaron Boone beat him in the playoffs with a home run. Oh. So I was talking about Aaron Boone, and the Panther fans were yelling and screaming. Little did I know this thing was being pumped into Reliant Stadium. So anyway, that was what I remember. They asked me a question, it was a long answer, but that's what I remember about the, And then the game started, and it was the game, and sadly, we lost on a field goal at the end.
Yeah, I was listening to you as I was driving back from the golf course on Sunday on PGA Tour Radio, and it struck me. I said, this is a guy on Super Bowl Sunday who's at Phoenix, but he's actually called the game on Super Bowl Sunday. And from a local perspective, I said, you know, next time I talk to Bill, I've got to ask him about that because it had to be just a little bit different. So thank you for taking the time to do that. Bill Rosinski's with PGA Tour Radio, Sirius XM, our guest taking Dead Aim. He was on the call, on the ground all weekend at the Waste Management Phoenix Open. What struck me, and we know Webb Simpson's a great player. Webb Simpson is a major champion. I watched him snare one away from Jim Furyk when Furyk made the slightest opening at the Olympic Club. We watched what he did at the TPC a couple of years ago. But, Bill, to me, this was next-level stuff when he rinsed the tee ball on 15 and took bogey. Finau makes par and walks off the 15th green with a two-shot lead, three to play. Finau actually plays a little conservative, but, you know, he had a two-shot lead with three to play. And for Simpson just to bulldog it like that and catch him on the 18th and then win it on the playoff hole, that was really impressive stuff to me.
It was, and I thought when we walked off 15 green into the tunnel to take it to the Coliseum, as they call it, the par 3 16th, I thought Finau had locked up the golf tournament because going into the final round, Simpson had played 16, 17, and 18 in one over par. And he had made a bunch of pars, and he bogeyed 17 on Saturday. Just hit a bad tee shot, yeah. tried to make an up and down birdie, ends up making a bogey. In fact, I think he had to make a 20-footer on Saturday to make a five on that hole. So they both par 16. And then we go to 17, and Finau tees off first, and he did not use driver. I'm not sure what the club was, some metal that he had in his bag, and he puts it in the middle pot bunker that's right in the middle of the fairway. I mean, normally when you're watching a tee shot, it's going down the middle of the fairway, you're thinking, oh, this could be pretty good. And it was short enough that it never had a chance. It went in that bunker. You know, maybe another 2 yards left or right, it misses the bunker, runs up the fairway, and he probably chips up close and has a chance to make the birdie. Instead, he comes up to his golf ball, kind of, you know, it's a small bunker, it's a little on the upslope, and you've got water around that thing. You got water left, you got water in the back, and the pin's in the back of the green, so how aggressive are you going to be? Simpson, his tee shot, if he wasn't on the green, he was just on the collar and won. Again, for our listeners, this is a par four, but they right. can drive it. So then he plays the bunker shot and still leaves himself 50 feet. And fortunately for him, he two-putts, so he gets a par on the play. But then Simpson made a fairly nice try. It was not going to go in for eagle, but he left himself, you know, like 3 or 4 feet, made the putt. So now we're down to one. And then we go to 18, and Finau hits a 366 off the tee.
What does that look like from your – I mean, I've never been present for something that went 366 off the tee. Does that just look like a howitzer disappearing into the horizon?
Well, see, I'm usually out by the fairway, you know, the way we call these things. And I saw him swing. And it's kind of hard to pick the ball out sometimes. So I'm looking at the landing area where most of the tee shots go.
And you have a sense of timing in your head of, okay, 1,001, right. 1,002, 1,003, right. I'm going to start looking.
Right. Right. And then you hear this thud. Well, the thud came from my right. And I didn't see the ball land because I was standing to the right. There's a fairway bunker on the right. And I didn't, but it landed past the bunker. And then just kept on rolling and ended up like in the first cut of rough. On the rough, there's nothing. So it was not a problem for him. And Webb had already hit his tee shot down the middle. So here's, and then Simpson plays his second. And he's got, it's hole high right, almost hole high right, but he's got 17 feet. And Finau knocks it stiff, 8 feet, eight feet left. And that left it down to the two putts. And Finau had not played great. He was one over on the front nine. He made a great par, like a 20-footer at 10 to save par, and then he had a couple of birdies, birdie 12 and 13, took the lead over Simpson by one, and then Webb made the bogey at 15, setting up what we saw at the end. Of course, then, you know, Simpson makes his 17-footer. Finau, I thought, hit a really good putt. It wouldn't go. Cut in front of the hole, left to right breaker, and then they had the playoff hole, and once again, Simpson knocked it tight, made a 10-footer, and won the thing. So it was great theater. And I talked to Tony after it was over, And he and Webb are really good friends. But you could see the heart. You know, his family was there. He just moved to that area of the country. He now lives in the Phoenix area. And, you know, everybody had talked about this not being able to finish the deal. He's had a lot of second-place finishes, one tour win. I think the next one will come sooner than later.
Well, and I keep hearing an apt comparison to back in the day with David Duval, who was in sort of the same situation. You had a guy who was just finishing second and third, and he was top tenning all the time. He's an ATM machine. And then once David was able to break through, he broke through in a big way. He didn't just win one, he won 10. You know, it happened in a hurry. And I get the feeling that Finau could do that if he could just break through that one time.
I think you're right, and it's going to come down to, as you know, this is about making putts.
Yeah,
he's got 8.5 feet to win the golf tournament, and we're not talking about a playoff. And he couldn't make it. He had a makeable birdie try on the playoff hole.
Well, and you, I heard your call, and this is the one that stuck in my head. When you called his right before he was putting on 15, and granted, I'm in the car, so I'm not seeing it. But from your call and the way you were talking, you really felt like, okay, you know, this is 5-6 feet, but this is really makeable. You know, he's going to make this birdie putt. And you were legitimately surprised that he missed that putt on 15.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? The day before, he'd missed a 6-footer at 15. He pured an iron from 229 to be hole high right in two shots, and he had 6 feet and didn't make the putt. But when you talk to him after that round, that shot, and on Sunday, he thought he'd made both. He thought he'd made those. He thought he hit the putt. He thought, you know, the line, the speed, everything was going to be good. And for some reason, it didn't go in. He's worked a lot on his putting. He's changed his setup a little bit, a little higher up on the grip. And that's it. That's it. You know, all these tournaments, Charlie, it's all about the short game, making up and down, you know, trying to, you know, to me, it's many, many times where you make a par when you should be given a shot away that helps you win a golf tournament. Nobody looks at it because it might happen on Thursday or Friday,
right,
you know, whatever day it is. But there's a lot of those on the tour. When you go back and look at a guy like Webb Simpson, you know, he makes a 20-footer on 17 Saturday for bogey.
Yeah.
Right? He misses that, you know, we're not even talking about a playoff.
Bill Rozinski's with PGA Tour Radio and Sirius XM, our guest taking Dead Aim. Back to the 15th. You walk off the 15th hole. Finau's got a two-shot lead. Like you said, you thought it was the tournament was over. I think everybody thought the tournament was over. As you're walking through the tunnel, through into the cathedral, what was Webb's body language like? Did he look deflated at all?
No. I think, you know, Webb, and you've seen him play, and I've seen him play a lot. I don't get a lot of big emotion out of Webb. And I think part of that is his relationship with Paul Tesori, his caddy. They've been together a long time. They confer on everything. Off the course, they're very, religious guys, family guys. And I think if Webb had any inclination that he had lost the golf tournament at that point, I'm sure Paul Tesori said, hey, look, you know, we still got three to go here, buddy. Anything can happen, especially on those holes where you can make birdie. 17, 16, it's not a long hole, but, you know, you got 20,000 people screaming.
Yeah.
And that's just a different mindset. I get a kick out of that hole. This is my second year in a row doing this tournament. And every time I go in there and hear these fans and watch the players react to them, it's really a cool thing. I'm glad it's only once a year.
Yeah. Well, and that's my thing. I enjoy this one time a year. My problem is I'm starting to see it pop up other places on tour, like, for instance, at the Honda. I forget what hole it is, the bear trap or whatever at the Honda, that right, they've got the same setup. And I don't want to see it become a regular, commonplace thing on the PGA Tour. Now, was this, compared to last year, this seemed to me this was the first year that it was fully enclosed with people on all sides, or am I imagining things? Have the people always been behind the tee box, too?
Well, they haven't been always behind there, but I know the last year was my first year, and it was completely enclosed.
It was
last
okay.
Year. So yeah, they keep adding, and people don't realize because they don't talk about it enough. But 17 is lined with these big grandstands and suites and chalets, and 18 is the same way. And there are thousands of people around these last three holes. This crowd, you know, let's say at the U.S. Open, you might have 40,000 people at a U.S. Open. There's 150,000 people out here at this golf tournament in a day. And, you know, you got 20, you probably have 20, 30, maybe 40 or 50,000 around the last three holes. Now, a lot of them aren't paying attention to golf. and the crowd was smaller on Sunday. The real golf fan, you could tell. In fact, my wife who drives my cart said I could really tell the difference because they have this thing on 12 now. To the right of 12, the par 3, where Webb had the hole-in-1 on Saturday. It's a big hill, and then they put another, you know, grandstand, chalet type of thing for the people up there to eat and drink and be merry. And on Saturday, it was crazy. Just, you know, you couldn't hear yourself think. People, you know, screaming and yelling, talking, weren't paying attention to the guys hitting tee shots. Sunday was different. Sunday, a lot of those people out there were golf fans. You know, they were going to go home and watch the Super Bowl, but they were out there to see who's going to win this golf tournament. They were golf fans. And you could just tell the difference in the way they would react to golf shots and the way that they, you know, I'm not going to say respect because it's just a different attitude at this tournament, but there was just a different mindset. When guys were getting ready to tee off, everybody would calm down and let them hit the tee shot and not yell and scream. But it's a, it's very major-like, and it's fun for us calling golf shots because, you know, Thursday, Friday, if we're out the John Deere or even at Hilton Head and some guy is, you know, two or three under par, you might have a couple of claps. Hey, nice job. Here, I don't care who you are. I mean, it's a roar when somebody makes a great shot or makes a birdie. And it makes for good radio, good theater, and it's fun to do.
Get you out of here on this. Bill Rosinski with PGA Tour Radio and Sirius XM, our guest taking Dead Aim. He was on the call at the Waste Management Phoenix Open. I want to talk about 16 in terms of what the Thunderbirds did and what the players did with the tribute to Kobe Bryant. That seemed every day to not get old for either the player or the viewer. Was it a cool thing for you guys to witness in person?
Oh, yeah, it was, because they, you know, they all put on the different jerseys, whether it was his high school jersey or a Laker jersey. Tony Finau did it. I know Justin Thomas. Justin had a couple, he had some wedges emblazoned with tributes to Kobe Bryant and his daughter and the others who perished in that helicopter crash. And then the tour on Sunday put the flag 24 paces up and 8 from the left, his two numbers with the Lakers, and then the flag. In fact, I think I tweeted out a picture on Twitter. The flag was Laker gold and purple with the number in purple, and it was 8 on one side and 24 on the other. And, you know, it was like that all week long, even on Wednesday during the Pro-Am. And we, you know, you'd also remember, Charlie, that you're very close. When you're in Phoenix, you're obviously very close to California. There's a lot of Laker fans out there. Would have been a little different if we were back on the East Coast, maybe. But it was just, it had everything, all the elements fell in place for this to be a great tribute to Kobe Bryant.
From Sirius XM and PGA Tour Radio, that's Bill Rosinski. And when we return, Ron Green Jr. takes Dead Aim at a little Webb, a little Connor Moore, and the blankety-blank USGA and R&A Distance Report, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. When Ron Green Jr. and I spoke on Tuesday, I wanted to talk about Webb Simpson's big win. I wanted to talk about Ron's article in the Global Golf Post about impressionist Connor Moore. But soon the conversation turned to the USGA and R&A's distance report that had just come out that morning. And anyway, all right, Ron, we'll get to the USGA report here in a minute, and we'll get to Pebble and all that. But the two things I want to talk about. First off, I knew that Webb Simpson was a bulldog, but this was elevation bulldog level on Sunday. I mean, he rinses his tee shot on 15, walks off 15, two down, three to play with the 16th hole, the drivable 17th, and with how far they hit it, a short 18th hole at Phoenix. I thought it was over. I really did. I'm like, okay, Webb's solid in second place. Going to be a good finish. Holy cow! He dang near jars it on 16, misses the putt for birdie, but then drives the green on 17, makes that great birdie on 18, and before Finau could even blink, he's in a playoff. That was amazing stuff by Webb Simpson.
Yeah, I mean, it was the way you go win golf tournaments. You know, some people may say Tony Finau lost it. Well, I think Webb went out and won it. I mean, birdie. That's what you sort of imagine. I mean, let's go steal it. I mean, you know, but he's been playing so well for so long. You go back, I want to say, till the 1st of July, he's now won once, lost in a playoff, and has four second-place finishes. I mean, there's a reason he's number seven in the world this week, and without playing, he's already knows he's going to number six in the world next week, which qualifies him for the Olympics if that were today, which, of course, it is.
Well, one thing that struck me a couple of years ago when he won the Players about Webb, and this is something that I think is actually the hardest thing as a golfer to do, is to be fearless of going low. And people rolled their eyes at that and say, what are you talking about? I would never be afraid. No, there's something about when you get to a certain threshold in your golf game and you have to fight the temptation to just play it safe. And Webb is an assassin. He fearlessly goes after birdies, almost like no one I've ever seen when he gets on a roll. And it's an amazing mindset he has. And for him to have that mindset on Sunday, I'm beyond impressed.
Yeah, I think he it was good he had it because he was going to be forced to have it, given the situation he was in, the position he was in. And, you know, I mean, Tony Finau, we can sit here and wonder if he made the mistake there on that 17th tee when he had three wood or something, hit it in that fairway bunker and really cost himself a good chance of making birdie. And, you know, did he get a little careful there, you know, when Webb just fired away because he had to? I think particularly when you're playing with confidence, players get that way. And like I said, you go back and look at his run of tournaments, the past 10 or 12 starts or whatever, he's got no reason not to be confident. He's not the longest guy on tour. He's brilliant at picking the places that work for him in terms of playing, whether it's Phoenix or the Hope or Sony, he was out there. Hilton has a great place for him. But he's outstanding from 150 yards in, and I would, unless somebody can convince me otherwise, I would say more than any other player who was an anchor putter guy, he has come through that the best of all of those guys. He immediately, you know, famous story about breaking his long putter, saying, I got to do it this other way, committed to it. It took him a while, but you know, he's back up and running. I mean, he's won a Players, he's won a U.S. Open, he's won six tournaments. I mean, he's a heck of a player.
Why do you think it is that he's the one who's been able to solve the riddle? Because you're right, of all of them, he's the one who has you know, broken through and found a way to be successful again.
Well, I think probably two reasons. One, I think he found a method that works for him, and he believes in it. And my sense is, he decided not to fight it. I think some of those guys still probably fight, I don't want to say feeling sorry for themselves, but wishing it was the other way. We've seen Adam Scott putt conventionally, do the Bernhard Langer, Scott McCarron style, try this, try that. Just hasn't quite settled on what works for him consistently. I mean, Keegan Bradley has sort of gradually come around. I think it's a huge sort of a seismic change for those guys. And, you know, Webb will tell you it wasn't easy early, but he was committed to finding something, and he did.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking dead aim. One of the main reasons I wanted to talk with you this week is I think your piece was just in the plus-plus of Global Golf Plus.
It was in the Monday edition.
If I say the name Connor Moore, a lot of people are going to scratch their head and say, I have no idea who this is. But if I showed you the commercial of the guy who's imitating everyone on the PGA Tour absolutely to perfection, you'd go, oh, that guy. How did you hook up with this interview? What did you find him to be like?
Well, he's just a guy I thought would be a good story, and I've been trying to do it for a while and just, you know, coordinating schedules or whatever. And thankfully, it finally worked out. He was in Orlando at the merchandise show, and the Golf Channel guys who I've been working with put us together. Ironically, I at Port Rush at the Open Championship last year on Sunday afternoon, he was sitting right beside me during the final round. And I introduced myself, told him what I wanted to do. We were chatting, and he was obviously locked into Shane Lowry and all that. And, you know, when it became apparent Shane was going to win that golf tournament, I kind of reached under the desk there where we were sitting and pulled out a little gym bag full of stuff, had his little beard and all that stuff, and was off to go make a video that was going to pop up in about 2 hours. So, you know, he'd been working on it for a while. But, I mean, I think, you know, if you watch enough golf, you see that impersonations he does, you see it online, and I think we're going to see more of that. I mean, the Golf Channel has got him doing some stuff for them, and it just, who was he? Where did it come from? How did it happen and all that? And, you know, once he sort of nailed Tiger and, you know, did a Bridgestone commercial and all that, I mean, sort of really set him off and running, and it was great fun to talk to. I mean, I think he sort of laughs at it all, too. I mean, he loves it. He was working for a telephone company, a telecommunications company, trying to sell you on new telephone packages, and did a couple of things for his buddies, making fun of some Irish football things that had happened. And next thing you know, he said, all right, I'm going to give this a try. And here he is.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the breakthrough was his imitation of Poulter and the fact that Poulter embraced it, right?
I think most of them embraced it. You know, as I said, Padraig Harrington was the first.
The first, okay.
Rory. And I think they're all of them. I think he does a great Poulter. And when I mentioned it to Poulter last year, he said he was brilliant. And I think the fact that he does it in such a sort of good-natured, sort of warm, almost fuzzy way that you know, there's no edge to it. It's I think that's part of what works. And, you know, he's really good at it. I mean, he, like Rory said, when I talked to him, he goes, I almost don't like him because he's so good. He said, I like all of them, but how he does me. And then Tiger said, you know, he loves him, and just said, but I don't say that. I don't say the things he says I do. I say more than that. And I was like, well, he's pretty much nailed it. And, you know, he told me the whole story about, took him 4 nights to figure out Tiger. Guys kept wanting him to do it, and he was reluctant. And he said, I just couldn't do it. And finally, he hit on it and got it, the really, really tough thing. So, it works, and, you know, I think I know he told me he was doing one in advance of the Oscars, doing various actors. I know he's done Matthew McConaughey before. So I'd be interested to see that one.
Now, did I read correctly that Jack actually has requested that he learn how to do Jack?
He said when he met him, he said, yeah, Jack knew he didn't do it, says, you need to do me. And he said, he's a little... he wants to make sure he gets that one right before he trots that one out. But I think that's sort of his mountaintop to climb this year.
Oh, that would be fantastic. No one ever does Nicholas. It would be super. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. As we're recording this conversation, you've just written a piece on the distance report from the USGA. In a nutshell, what did the report say, and how is it going to affect me and you, the average Joe Blow golfer?
Well, the report said what we already knew, but this has literally more than 100 pages of data to back it up, that for 100 years, golf and golf courses and the game have continued to, distance has continued to grow and increase over decades. I mean, from where we started, where it was 100 years ago to where it is now and where it may be going. And the USGA and the RNA in collaboration have determined it needs to stop, that... And the words of Mike Davis, the idea of every generation hitting it longer than the previous generations needs to end. And there are multiple reasons for that. There's just the real estate of it. I mean, it's become, you know, a lot of courses can't expand. They can't get longer. And they're threatened, you know, at least from top players, of being sort of overpowered. And I think there's a sense that an element of the skill, especially at the highest level, has been taken out of the game with the equipment and with the distances players can hit it. And they want to roll that, not necessarily roll that back, but They don't want it to keep going. I don't think anybody wants to see 8,000-yard golf courses. Nobody is saying the game is too easy for most of us. I mean, it's a hard game. I think it is easier than it used to be. But I think it's still, as my handicap would attest, it's still a very difficult game. And so I think they have they put all this compelling case together about here's what it is, here's what we've seen, here's what we can just prove via scientific data. Now, what are we going to do about it? And they are going to have in about 45 days, they're going to send out topics for discussion to various constituencies. Obviously, the equipment companies are a huge part of this. They want their collaboration. They want to talk with the tours and various other groups, you know, superintendents. I mean, agronomy has helped golf courses a lot. Athleticism is part of it. They don't want to change that. And Mike Davis from Martin Slumbers once said, we don't want to take away what you have right now. But I think they want to sort of harness it and sort of curtail it. So I think it's going to be a year from now, they're going to come back to us, I would have imagined, say, all right, here's what we've talked about. Here's what equipment company said. Here are our findings. Now, here are our proposed solutions to this. What those are, I don't know. Both Martin Slumbers and Mike Davis, they say they want to keep one set of rules, but they have raised the possibility of instituting what they call a local rule that would allow clubs or tournaments to restrict the equipment there. In other words, bifurcate the equipment. And I don't think our clubs are going to do that. I don't think the average golfer is going to have two sets of equipment, you know, or two kinds of golf balls they could use. But, you know, would the PGA Tour, at the urging of the USGA and the RNA, say, all right, everything's got to be 90% of what it was? I don't see that happening. I don't see why the PGA Tour would do it, because it's not broken. I mean, the tour is very popular. People love to see players bomb it. Now, I think it goes too far. I think rolling it back wouldn't hurt. I think, you know, I mean, you said earlier, I think Tony Finau steps up on 18 and rips it 366 on Sunday like it's nothing to it. That's an awfully long way to hit a golf ball, and he's not the longest guy out there, though he's one of the longest. I think forcing players to hit longer clubs into par fours and not making every par five automatically reachable by virtually everybody in the field at the highest level would be a good thing. But again, are you going to, you know, legislate the game based on 2,000 players around the world? Or you've legislated for, you know, the 25 million people who go out there and play and love the challenge and all that? There's so many different constituencies, and while everybody agrees there are challenges to it, I wonder if it's not golf's unsolvable problem.
I think so. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. The three things that pop out from what you just said to me. Number one, I remember a quote from Byron Nelson years ago where they asked him what the greatest advancement in technology had been in his lifetime, and he said the lawnmower. always remember that. Yeah. So there's been tremendous advances in agronomy. I think, like you do, that this is a problem for the highest of the high levels. And I just remember last year playing in a media challenge out at Quail Hollow Club. And it was a three-hole challenge. And the 18th, they had us play it all the way back where the pros do. And I hit a drive about as well as I can hit one on that 18th hole. And I had to hit a club into that green that I don't ever have to hit into par fours, like ever. And my index is between a one and a two. And so I'm, you know, better than your average club golfer. And so I feel like, you know, I don't want them to come after me because it's hard enough for me. I think we're talking about something at the highest level. And the third thing, I don't know how to say this other than to use this word. Has the RNA and the USGA taken the easy way out and basically said, you know what, Augusta National, it's in your court. Because they know damn well the PGA Tour isn't going to fix what's broken. Chicks dig the long ball. Are they basically going to make Augusta National be the club that says, okay, here's our new ball for the Masters?
I don't think, Fred Ridley essentially said last year that he did not foresee the day when they would institute their own golf ball. Now, they're like the PGA Tour, the European Tour, and others. They are, you know, collaborators in this initiative. I think they will have their say. I think, as Fred Ridley said, they don't want to change the 13th hole down there at Augusta, but they hate that the second shot there is no longer a momentous decision, that for most of them they're hitting 7-8 irons into that green, which is not what it was designed to do. Guys don't even hit driver off the tee there anymore. They hit 3-wood or something and turn it around there because they can hit those so far. I think that's where you see, especially, at that level, where the game has changed, and it's not the same thing. Now, Patrick Mahomes can throw for 350, 400 yards because the football's changed now. It's not the way Johnny Unitas played it. When you threw for 250 yards, you were shredding a defense, and everything changes. But, somebody made the point that football doesn't change its fields, and, basketball court doesn't get bigger, tennis court doesn't get bigger, but golf courses keep getting bigger. It's the one sport where the field of competition changes and has to keep expanding. And maybe, go ask your superintendent. Does he want to have to put more water on a bigger piece of property? I'm sure he doesn't. Most clubs, A, don't have the room to do it, or B, don't have the money to buy new land and expand. So, but yet there are places like, say, let's go play this place. It's 6,000 yards. A lot of us are going to say, that doesn't really count as like a full golf course. That's not right, but that's the way people feel.
Get you out of here on this as someone who's been out there more than once. I was asked last week by someone what golf course I felt like TV, even the highest of the high def, the 4K, the 5K TV, didn't do justice to. And my answer is always the same. Until they figure out a way for a television to show the hilliness of Augusta National, you'll never quite understand what a tough walk Augusta National is. That being said, the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am this week out at a National Treasure, Pebble Beach National Golf Links, does it do justice on the highest definition television, or do you still have to go out there and see it to believe how gorgeous it is?
I agree with you that Augusta is the one, because no matter how many times I see or talk to first timers down there, what they always say is, I didn't realize how hilly it was. Pebble, you can get your movie screen up there and it's just gorgeous. It is just made for cameras. But still, the vastness of it, and sort of just letting it all sort of wash over you when you're out there and looking at it. You sort of stare at those cliffs at 8 and going up the right side of the 6th hole. If you can get close enough to the 7th hole to look down there, going out 8, 9, 10, all that. It's just gorgeous. It's magnetic. It sort of pulls you in. And I've been fortunate to be there a lot of times, and you never get tired of looking at it. It just, 18 is the famous one, but I think the other ones are the prettier ones. There's nothing wrong with 18 at all, but I think when you're going the other way, there's more elevation change there. It's just, if any place is worth $575 for a round of golf, that's the one.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr. And up next, Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com and the Golf Channel takes dead aim at this report from the USGA and RNA that will live in infamy. Presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
We're Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. By the time I spoke with Ron Cyrak of Ron Cyrak and the Golf Channel on Thursday, I'd pretty much worked myself into a lather over the USGA and RNA's distance report. Okay, Ron, I'm talking with you today because you're my usual voice of reason to keep me from just jumping off the deep end, because the more I read this, I keep reading the USGA and RNA report, hoping to see something differently than what I'm seeing, and I'm just not. I'm upset on a number of different levels. The first thing that pops out to me is this thought in my head that these are the governing bodies for the game worldwide. And I feel like they should be the biggest advocates in the world for the 99.9% of guys who play golf. And it seems to me they are just ever concerned about the 0.1% and making the rest of us suffer because of the 0.1%. No, look, it doesn't take a genius. Anybody with two eyes sees how far the pros are hitting it. And it's insane, it's obscene, and it's eliminating golf courses for the pro level. But there's none of us, you and me, who are going back to the tips at Bethpage and saying, you know, we need to lengthen this.
Yeah, they're dancing all around the word bifurcation. They don't want to use it. They've really been hanging their hat, both the RNA and the USGA, on the fact that they like it, that we all play by the same rules. Except that's not true. We don't all play by the same rules, you know. I mean, you go out on Saturday with your group, there's mulligans, there's gimmies, there's stuff that's not in the rules of golf. And you're right. This is the impact here is on competitive golf on the professional level. And the danger is you don't want courses like the old course at St. Andrews or Parish the Thought, Augusta National, to become obsolete by distance. But it's not affecting everybody else. And I think that they're going to have to deal with that. And, you know, reading between the lines, part of what they were saying is, one way they might go is to allow essentially local rules on distance. Well, then what that does, that means we're all playing by the same rules, except every golf course that has a PGA Tour event could establish a local rule involving equipment and distance.
Well, and this brings me to a rather harsh word. It's a strong word, but it's the only one that I think fits this, and it is cowardice. I believe our governing bodies have acted like cowards in this situation. All they needed to do is say this. The pros are hitting it too dang far. We're calling a meeting of the manufacturers. We're going to roll it back, either the equipment or the golf ball for the professional, 10%. That's the way it's going to be. Everybody else, God bless you. Go out and enjoy our game and invite two more people to play. And no one would have had a problem with that. But this obsession with trying to have us all play the same game, and then with this local rule, you and I both know what this is going towards. The cowardice comes into play here, and that the RNA and the USGA didn't want to make a decision. So now we're going to throw it at the feet of Fred Ridley and Augusta National to be the only grown-up at the adult table and to stand up and to do something, because, quite frankly, they have to do something to protect their golf course. And they know that they have the guts to do it, because Augusta National's philosophy is, if you don't like what we do, that's a you problem. You don't have to come here.
The elephant in the room is the equipment companies and the fear of lawsuits. No question about it. I remember in the early 2000s when the USGA, you know, right around, you know, 2000 is when we really changed the solid core golf ball, the 460cc driver, and distance started to increase. You know, I went back and looked at the stats. In 1999, the leading driver on the PGA Tour was John Daly at 305.6 yards. He was the only person on the tour who averaged over 300 yards. Last year, the leading driver on tour was 317.9 yards. 50 players averaged over 300. So clearly, distance is impacting the pro game, but they are worried about lawsuits from equipment companies. This local rule, it could be a way out around that. You know, allow them to continue to do their marketing around PGA Tour players, and not change the equipment for the recreational golfer.
You know, you brought up a word at the very beginning that gets thrown around, and it's bifurcation. And you mentioned how we've had bifurcation for a while. You brought up one example. I'll give you another. professional golf and is to regular golf as what NASCAR and regular driving used to be. It's all different now with NASCAR, but back in the day, Dale Earnhardt Sr. Chevrolet was not the Chevrolet you were driving on the street, even though the body sure looked the same. The Callaway Maverick or Callaway Rogue driver that you're using in your bag, I can promise you, is not the one that's in their bag out there. Their shaft costs twice as much as your driver does, and their ball has been custom engineered for their exact swing tendencies. So we've already been playing a bifurcated game.
Yeah, you know, and what you just touched on right there is the aspect of technology that the RNA and the USGA did not anticipate, and that's computer technology. Computer optimization, you know, they can get a player come in and work on their range at whatever equipment company they're at, and they can optimize launch angle, spin rate. They can customize the equipment so perfectly. I've talked to players who said, you know, they go in, they work with the technicians, and they can find 10, 12 yards, you know, just by changing the specs that they have. We don't have any of that advantage, you know, and that's something that I think the two things that the USGA didn't see coming is the use of computers. I mean, you go to the range now, they all got a track man out there. They're all figuring out the launch angles and things. And the other thing is the physical conditioning of players. They're bigger and stronger. I've said it to you before. Part of the legacy of Tiger Woods is going to be he attracted a better quality of athlete to golf, and he taught them the importance of working out. Bigger, stronger guys with better equipment are hitting the ball a long way.
Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com and the Golf Channel, our guest taking Dead Aim. And then I see a couple of guys who work for the USGA, Mike Pagel, and I forget who the other guy was, who were on the Golf Channel talking. And they threw out another infamous USGA word that every time I hear it makes me want to throw up in my mouth. When it was asked of them, do you intend, you know, what is your, do you intend to harm the game for the average golfer? Do you intend to take away their distance and whatnot? And they said, well, you know, it's never our intention to do whatever. Can we get rid of that word? No one ever intends to do anything. No one intends to have their ball move in the bunker when they remove a rock. No one ever intends. You know, nobody intends for these things to happen, but they do, and they break the rules. I just can't get away from it. I feel like the little guy, the overwhelming majority in the game of golf, is not being properly represented at the table by the group that's supposed to do it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we saw that with the long putter and the anchoring. I mean, I play golf on Saturday morning with a lot of guys who anchored their putter, and it made the game more enjoyable for them. And it was hard. The USGA is in a situation where they are running the risk of becoming sort of what the NCAA is becoming in college football, which is irrelevant. You know, the important decisions are being made outside of the NCAA in terms of compensating players, in terms of the playoffs and things like that. And the USGA is in the danger of falling into that sort of situation. They do have to. I mean, I've been arguing for years that the executive committee of the USGA is not only private clubs, it's elite private clubs on there.
Thank you.
Public golf needs to be represented in the USGA, better represented in the USGA. They need to have three public golf courses represented among the 15 people on the executive committee.
Thank you so much for bringing that up, because the other aspect of this that angers me is that I feel like the USGA has just decided we are going to become uber protective of our historic courses in the Northeast Corridor that we're upset have been, outdated by distance. I'm speaking specifically of places like Marion. And look, I hate that the U.S. Open probably should not go back there. Look, after last summer, I don't know if the U.S. Open should go back to Pebble Beach, to be honest with you, for the same reasons. But that being said, again, for the vast majority, you can step back on the tips tomorrow, Marion, Ron, and it'll be more golf course than you can handle.
You know, one of the things, as you know, I love baseball. I'm a big baseball fan. One of the cool things about baseball, Wrigley Field and Fenway Park were built in 1912, and they're still relevant in the game. And it's good that baseball has that those iconic venues to be able to market around and to be able to attract fans to. And I used to have this argument with some of the equipment editors that I work with at Golf Digest and Golf World, you know, who would say, oh, so what if a course becomes obsolete? You know, we'll just build better, newer courses. Well, you know, that's part of the history of the game. We don't want those venues to go away. And you know, the part of the value part of the expense that increased dramatically in golf over the last 20, 30 years is when they build golf courses now, they're building them bigger and bigger and bigger, which is more expensive to build, more expensive to maintain, and then more expensive to play. And again, I don't think that those pay daily fee golf courses are represented adequately in the USGA. They need to be better protected by the governing bodies.
Ron Czyrak with RonCzyrak.com and the Golf Channel, our guest Taking Dead Aim. I really wanted to talk with you about a group that it hasn't been talked about how it will affect, and I think it has big ramifications for the women's game, which I have been so happy with the growth, especially in the women's amateur game in the last few years, and the LPGA. Last year at the Augusta National Women's Invitational, the best female amateur golfers in the world played from the members' tees at Augusta National, and you were looking at Kupcho and Fosse on the 13th hole having to hit hybrids and three woods for their second shot, just as it was intended. The women's game is fine. You've got your unicorns, your Lexi Thompsons, but they're not winning every week. And you know, I think that you would really be punishing the women's game by rolling things back.
Yeah, they you know, and you know, I've been saying this for a long time. For the life of me, I don't get why equipment companies don't do more marketing to men around women golfers, because those are the specs that we should be playing, you know, is what they're playing. And it is. Last year, I went and checked these numbers. Last year, the leading driver on the LPGA was Ann Van Dam, who averaged 289 yards. I mean, that's amazing. Considering in 1999, the leading driver on tour averaged 261 yards. So that's almost 30 yards difference there. So it is impacting that, but it is more of a strategic game. There's no question about it. And you look at the top 10 in the Rolex rankings, probably half of them are long hitters. But you know, you got your NB Parks of the world, you know, who don't hit it very far and are hitting hybrids into par fours and are still winning golf tournaments. Well, to me, I mean, it was cool that Ben Hogan had to hit a one iron into the 72nd hole at Marion in 1950 and not a sand wedge.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And it's like I said, you're never going to get me to argue that the pro men's game isn't out of control. What's interesting to me is you're never going to hear the PGA Tour say that, because, Lord, their business couldn't be better. They're about to sign enormous TV contracts. Their sponsorships are up. Their players are making more money than ever. They've got more fans coming out than ever before. The state of their union is good. Chicks dig the long ball. They know it, and they don't want to change anything. So that's really the irony here, is that you've got the governing bodies that want to punish the pro game that doesn't want to do anything, and those of us that are kind of stuck between that are the ones that are eventually going to pay.
Yeah, you know, that's a problem that we have in that the PGA Tour, for instance, and the USGA, the PGA of America, and even the equipment companies don't always have the same agenda going, because the PGA Tour doesn't really matter very much to the PGA Tour whether they increase the number of golfers. They just need to increase the number of golf fans, and the long ball is doing that, and distance won't become an issue to them till it impacts the entertainment value of the game. If it gets to the point, I mean, right now, and this is one of the good things Mike Davis brought to golf, was the drivable par four. I love the drivable par four. We just didn't think 440-yard holes were going to become drivable par fours.
You're so right. So at the end of the day, what do you foresee? What's going to be the solution? What's going to be the final resolution once the dust really settles? And we're probably talking 2-3 years from now.
Yeah, it does sound like it's going to be years away. I think they want to see what the reaction is going to be to what they said this week. But I think they're going to go that local rule route. You know, I think that they're going to leave the equipment standards the same for everybody out there, but let tournament venues and tournament sites adjust rules if they need to. I was fascinated last year at the Masters on Wednesday when the chairman had his annual press conference, that when Chairman Ridley was asked about, are you going to move the tee back at number 13 now that you have that land back there, his response was, we're going to wait and see what the RNA and the USGA does on distance. Clearly, they knew this was coming. They knew something like this was coming. The question is, how long can they afford to wait around for the USGA to make a decision and decide how they're going to act?
Do you think, if given a choice between altering perhaps the most iconic par 5 in golf or coming up with a special Masters golf ball, which decision do you think Ridley goes to first?
I would think that he'd go with the golf ball.
I do, and too.
And I felt that way. I felt that way when Hootie, when they were first Tigerizing the course, you know, Tiger-proofing it back then, because honestly... You know, I was there in 1997 when Tiger overwhelmed the par fives back there. I had no problem that he was hitting 9-iron and wedge into par fives and making eagles on there, because you could make 7 just as easily on those holes. And I love that people, I mean, those greens are difficult. There's the false front, particularly on 15. It's not easy shots to get in there. You can gamble. You can make 3, but you can make 7 just as easily. I had no problem with the way the holes played.
From RonCyrak.com and the Golf Channel, that's my voice of reason, Ron Cyrak. I'd also like to thank Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, and Bill Rosinski from SiriusXM and PGA Tour Radio for their time and insight this week. A reminder, if you're catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BPod Studios, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there now are links to articles on the latest goings-on in and around the game. Weather-wise, well... You know, at least we're not dodging the rain. We're going to be in the floodwaters, but at least we're not dodging the rain. It's going to be a little chilly, too. But, hey, there's some opportunities in the Carolinas this weekend for teeing it up and letting this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And if you do put a peg in the ground or just slide it into the mud or let the ball just sink gradually, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.